Hello, and thank you for joining us for this episode of the Nation of Writers podcast. This podcast is presented in conjunction with our new virtual exhibit, American Voices, which you can explore at nationofwriters.org. In this episode, we'll discuss the life and work of Japanese-American author Hisai Yamamoto. You can learn more about Yamamoto by exploring our virtual exhibit on Google Arts and Culture. I also highly recommend you read her work as it is powerful and accessible. As we are creating this exhibit, I found myself engrossed by her writing, particularly her short stories. Not only are they quite short, but her language is precise and engaging, and she is able to express a multitude of ideas in elegantly simple prose. 17 syllables is a great place to start. Go read it. Now a little bit about our guests. Today we're joined by University of Colorado at Boulder professor Cheryl Higashida and young adult author Misa Sugiura. Cheryl works on ethnic and American literatures, sound studies, and Marxism. Her essays have appeared in American Literature, American Quarterly, and Afro-Asia, Revolutionary Political and Cultural Connections Between African Americans and Asian Americans. She is the author of Black Internationalist Feminism, Women Writers of the Black Left, 1945 to 1995. Her current research is on sound technology, social movements, and race in the 20th and 21st centuries. Misa Sugiura writes stories for young people. Her debut novel, It's Not Like It's a Secret, won the Asian Pacific Islander Librarians Association Award for Young Adult Literature. And her critically acclaimed second novel, This Time Will Be Different, was selected by the New York Public Library, the Chicago Public Library, and the Young Adult Library Services Association as one of the best YA novels of 2019. Her latest book, Love and Other Natural Disasters, will be released on June 8, 2021, and has been praised by the American Library Association as hilariously awkward and honestly poignant. Her short stories have appeared in an anthology of immigrant stories for teens and in the New York Times. Misa lives in the San Francisco Bay Area with her husband, two sons, and three cats. Misa is also one of more than 30 authors featured in our special exhibit, My America, Immigrant and Refugee Writers Today, available to explore in person or online at my-america.org. Cheryl, Misa, thank you for being with us here today.
It's our pleasure.
Yeah, great to be here.
So, you know, first, let's just get started. Maybe you could tell me a little bit about what you're up to now and maybe what you've been doing this pandemic time. Cheryl, maybe you could start.
Yeah, sure. So I've been working on my current research, which is on the interdependent development of social movements in the US and sound media like the phonograph, telephone, and radio, and how this intersects with what we're with Hisai Yamamoto is that the current chapter I'm working on is on the Asian American movement and radio media activism. And I'm looking at a lot of radio plays that were developed by activists involved with the KPFA Berkeley Third World News Bureau, who then branched off and developed all these really great projects, including radio drama, especially a Filipino American artist and activist named Norman Jayo. And so this group of incredible artists and activists were really doing all of this amazing work in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. And they were of a generation, of a younger generation than Yamamoto, but they were also intersecting when she was, of course, continuing to write, and when Asian American activists like Frank Chin and Sean Wong and Lawson Inada were putting out their anthology IE, and along with Jeffrey Paul Chan. And they were really instrumental in recovering writers like Hisai Yamamoto, Carlos Bulosan, Toshio Mori. And so all of this recovery work of older writers like Yamamoto was also feeding into this newer work, including radio plays, which haven't been as studied or listened to as much. And so there's a lot of really exciting overlap between older Asian American writers and these younger ones who are feeding off of and growing from writers like Yamamoto. And so their themes and interests just coalesce really beautifully.
Yeah, that's very interesting. And Misa, what are you working on, or what have you been spending your time doing in the pandemic?
Well, I have been writing or revising a book that's coming out in June. I'm a young adult author, so what the book that's coming out in June is called Love and Other Natural Disasters, and it's just straight up rom-com, although I use the word straight in a slightly different context, because it's actually about four queer girls who get entangled in a love triangle / quadrangle, complete with fake dating and shenanigans and hijinks. And I wrote that book as kind of a palate cleanser, just something fun and light after I wrote this other book, which is more my connection to Hisae Yamamoto, which is my second novel was called This Time Will Be Different. And it focuses on a young Japanese American girl, teen, whose family history is entangled with the Japanese American internment in World War II. And her family owns a little flower shop that was briefly taken away from them by a greedy white farmer, bought for pennies on the dollar, as happened with so many Japanese American landowners and property owners back then, and business owners. And I used this girl's story in the present to explore some of the things that happened in the past and the way they past injustices follow us into the present and how we deal with those things.
That's really interesting. Both of you, you can tell just from what you're working on that Yamamoto has had influence in your lives. And it's hard to discuss her work separate from what she had to endure with the internment and what her family had to go through, as part of all of Japanese Americans at the time, the injustice that was served and how she lived through it. Is really amazingly reflected in her work, which is, semi-autobiographical. Yeah, I don't know how you might say it like that, because it seems like whatever she was writing about was something she was deeply interested and moved by. I'm interested, Cheryl, how did you first encounter Yamamoto's work?
I first encountered her work in Asian American literature classes as an undergraduate at UC Berkeley, and then a graduate student at Cornell. And so I think a lot about how grateful I am and how we have to be for those young people and community members who really fought for ethnic studies in the 60s with the Third World Liberation strikes, that Asian Americans, as well as African Americans, Latinx, Indigenous people were so involved in to start ethnic studies that recovery work, the literary recovery work of publishing these writers who had just fallen into the dustbin quite literally at times. So I don't think we'd be talking right now about Yamamoto without them, and certainly without the work that the American Writers Museum continues to do.
Thank you. And Misa, how did you first encounter Yamamoto's work?
I too discovered her in college as an undergrad, and I honestly don't know how, because I did. I wrote my senior thesis on Japanese American literature and its sort of its place in history, and the way it evolved according to its historical context. And this was back in the days of the card catalog. So I can't remember if I found her by searching under, subject, Japanese American literature, or if maybe my thesis advisor mentioned her, because I wrote that thesis in 1990 and 1991, and Yamamoto had within very recent memory just won the American Book Award. So, that's where I found her. My college didn't have ethnic studies or Asian American studies or anything. That was just me kind of searching around and trying to create my own way of digging into that.
Yeah, that's like you did what a lot of folks had to do, is to kind of seek it out on their own, which it's kind of a shame. She's such a
a strong writer. Cheryl, I have to admit, the American Writers Museum was approached by Google Arts and Culture to develop this online exhibit. And before that, I did not know of her or her work. And I was blown away by how amazing of a writer she is. It was really, I found all kinds of influences from short story writers that I enjoy, but I'm curious, which writers do you think had the most influence on Yamamoto's work? And where do you maybe see that showing up in her work?
Well, Yamamoto, like many writers, read voraciously. And I was so struck by how she majored in French, German, Latin, I think Spanish as well. And then she had also gone to Japanese school. And so that informed just the range of people she read. So Rainer Maria Rilke, the Austrian poet, and Thomas Mann, the German novelist, kind of like Carlos Bulosan, who a great Filipino-American writer, just read everybody. But, you know, what I was also really struck by when I was revisiting some of the interviews that she had done, like one with King Kok Chung in the mid-90s, is that she also talks about Asian and Asian American writers that she's reading at the time. So like Karente Yamashita and Vikram Seth, Golden Gate, you know, which this novel written in sonnet form. So she was just, you know, as well as many, many short story writers, Toshio Mori, Tilly Olson. So she was just she had so many influences. And I think that also is reflected in her own writing.
Misa, what kind of influences have you seen or noticed?
Oh, well, I do not have a whole lot of background expertise on the like American short story scene before Yamamoto, but I do, you know, I mean, there are definitely echoes of themes, right? From, I'm thinking, especially the, well, the most obvious one, the one that springs to mind immediately was F. Scott Fitzgerald's Great Gatsby, right? With the car crash and the sort of, we can get more into that later, but, this sense of, the callousness, and the complete, sort of disconnect between white people in power and, you know, the struggling Japanese American community, like in particular in you know, a couple of different, in one story, two stories, in fact. I was struck by how many times a car crash appears in her stories.
Yeah, I was really like my background. I have an English degree. Primarily, I've published poetry, but I'm always interested in short stories because of the impact and power that they can have in a short amount of space. And I really, when I was reading her short stories, they reminded me a lot of like Hemingway. Just the power, the brevity, but also that kind of journalistic background, the almost reporting on what she's seeing and what she doesn't say almost is more powerful than the words she uses in the stories, you know. And I was like, if Hemingway could ever write like for women, it would be like he'd say, yeah. You know, I was like, you know, she was writing. I thought it was really. I was blown away. I was really so impressed. I was so excited to be able to talk to you guys about this because I can't believe more people don't read her. You know, so. Hopefully we can change that by people listening to this podcast and the exhibit we did.
She's such a master. I mean, I was struck again, I keep using that word, but her stories as short stories are, they're just so dense. They're so packed and layered with meaning and, you know, just reward a rereading and another rereading and, yeah, I had such a good time preparing for this podcast. You know, I told you, I only like had a very short time, but it's been a great a great short time to really delve deeply into her work.
Yeah, I guess so. What do you think, Mista, makes her work so enduring? Why do you think it should stick with people?
Oh, definitely. Just as a writer and sort of a big picture look, the themes, the opening story, The High-Heeled Shoes, it's the first story in the anthology, 17 Syllable. It's about sexual harassment, sexual assault, and the experience as a woman moving through the world and always having to be worried and always having to be conscious of men around you, and the feeling of helplessness that comes with something that might be considered a minor assault, or where you can't identify the criminal, or she really it just reminded me of the Me Too movement. Everything was what we've been hearing over and over. She could have written that story today and it would resonate exactly, I think. And then I was shocked to learn that she wrote it in 1948, and I just felt like that's just wild to me that someone was producing this. I guess I don't know if subversive is the right term, but this honest of an account. And yeah, and so there was that and other themes, like the feminist theme that runs throughout her writing. And I think that is sadly all too relevant today. And this intergenerational disconnect again between the Nisei and the Issei, mostly in her work, but parents and children, and how we're constantly sort of talking at each other, and our stories are completely overlapped, and yet we don't see the meaning of the stories of the other generation. That's evergreen.
Yeah, and you see that across immigration communities. Like it's just that first generation coming to kind of head with the second generation, because you want your kids to come and they start to assimilate, and then it's like there's that struggle between the back and forth. Do you, Cheryl, do you find any of Yamamoto's writing enduring in that same kind of way in what your subject matters are that you teach?
Yeah, absolutely. And just to build off of what Mista was saying, the ways in which she expresses and explores that intergenerational tension and conflict through the form of her writing is, I think, what makes it so remarkable that she, especially through writing from the perspective, as she often does, from a young child. And I would love to hear more of your thoughts, Mista, as a, such a powerful young adult writer, of how that resonates with your work as well, because, to be able to inhabit that position so authentically is just amazing. I mean, I have a 10-year-old and 16-year-old, and I can't imagine trying to write from their point of view. So when I read authors like yourself, Mista, and Yamamoto, who are able to do that and really allow readers to get into that voice and that mindset and perspective, it's just so amazing. And when Yamamoto does that, that's how she's able to get that layered perspective and that disconnect, because you as the reader are seeing things from that young, often the young girl's point of view, and you have that irony where you also see all the things that the young girl is missing that you're able to pick up on from the mother's point of view, or from a Mexican or Filipino laborer's point of view, one of these workers who are working for these Japanese Americans who, do own their own farms. And so that's how she's able to get at all of these different perspectives, both, the perspective of the first generation Issei, but also the perspectives of other ethnic and racial groups and the class tensions, as well as the gender and sexual tensions. And so it's just, it's really amazing.
Yeah, as a young adult writer, the goal is to write, like you said, like to inhabit that perspective of the teenager, which means then that we often don't include the adult perspective, right? It's not meant to tell us the story of the adult or to look at things from an adult's point of view, but use the young voice. So, in that sense, I feel like the young adult writers are slightly separate from what Yamamoto does, because she's sort of taking her adult perspective and transmuting it through the eyes of someone who doesn't understand the adult perspective, which I think is genius how she does that. But in my work, I feel like, oh, such a serious artist. But I find it impossible, and I don't know if it's just because I am the daughter of an immigrant, or if, you know, Yamamoto's work really did strike such a deep chord with me, the way she uses that interplay of perspectives and stories between children and their parents. I've been unable to extricate the adult story, the parent story, from the kid's story in my books. There's always a parent story going on in the background of the central teenage story. And I just think because that's what's happening in our lives, right? Our parents are having their own lives, and the kids are having their own lives. And unlike Yamamoto, I try to make it intersect, because my work, you know, young adult stuff is ultimately supposed to be hopeful. So there will be a point at which they each become a little bit more aware of, why is my mom being such a jerk about pushing me this way? Or why is my child such a stubborn, irascible person who doesn't listen to me? Because that always made me so sad when I read Yamamoto's work, is that those perspectives really, really didn't ever cross. And so in my work, I fixed it. And they do, and there is some kind of reconciliation at the end.
That was kind of the tension in a lot of her work too, was that tension between the generational thoughts and how they were operating within the characters. What I also found interesting was that she herself really didn't call herself a writer. She said she would have to refer to herself as a housewife, which, you know, when we talked to her children when we were getting the online exhibit together, they really didn't have a lot of memory of her as a writer, because she would do it late at night. Mm. Like, she, you know, took care of the family all during the day, and then she would write at night. So I don't know, Misa, do you have any kind of similar writing style where you kind of have to have the kids are all away asleep and then you start to work? Or, you know, how are you able to kind of juggle the two?
I do tend to write when my kids are at school. In fact, I decided to become an author, or try to become an author, when my youngest child went to first grade, right? So I had both my kids out of the house for a significant period of time, and I gave myself a year to write something and see if it worked. And otherwise I was going to go right back to work, because I had been at home with them until then. I make sure that my kids know that I'm writing and working as a writer. To me, that's important. That they don't see me as this like freeloading person who's just playing with a little hobby and like, oh, maybe she makes money sometimes, but it's a serious endeavor for me, as all art, I think, should be considered.
Yeah, we were kind of picking at it because as the American Writers Museum, we really like to know about the process, like how the writers work and what they're doing. And Cheryl, you had mentioned in an email that you had maybe a passage you wanted to read, and we could discuss a little bit about how Yamamoto's work comes through her writing and how she does it. Do you mind doing that?
Yeah, absolutely. And this does relate to the discussion about what it means to write as a woman and a mother. So it was really hard to pick one passage. And I felt like maybe I should pick something from a story that's not as well known. But I kept getting drawn back to her best known kind of iconic story, 17 syllables. Of course, the reference to the haiku form, which goes back to how her short stories are so condensed and powerful, like the haiku, which is able to, as Yamamoto writes, the haiku that must pack all the poet's meaning into 17 syllables only. So in the short story, 17 syllables, there's a passage early on where Rosie, another young female protagonist, is seeing her mother blossom into this poet who suddenly starts sending haiku poems to one of the Japanese American newspapers every week as a regular contributor under the pen name Ume Hanazono. And so the passage goes, quote, "So Rosie and her father lived for a while with two women, her mother and Ume Hanazono," the mother's pseudonym. "Her mother, Tome Hayashi by name, kept house, cooked, washed, and along with her husband and the Carrascos, the Mexican family hired for the harvest, did her ample share of picking tomatoes out in the sweltering fields and boxing them in tidy strata in the cool packing shed. Ume Hanazono, who came to life after the dinner dishes were done, was an earnest, muttering stranger who often neglected speaking when spoken to and stayed busy at the parlor table as late as midnight, scribbling with pencil on scratch paper or carefully copying characters on good paper with her fat, pale green Parker." So I love the way that passage thematizes exactly, you know, clearly in this kind of semi-autobiographical fashion, what Yamamoto would have to do after becoming a mother to five children. And it's just amazing to me that she was able to continue to write as she did, even though she wasn't the most prolific of writers. She did continue to produce these short stories throughout, into the latter part of the 1900s. But the passage also just formally speaks to what we were discussing earlier about how this is completely seen from the young girl Rosie's perspective, and how this is just all she sees of the mother, the mother as poet, as this stranger who just goes off and does her mystical thing. She can't really grasp at what it means to the mother and you know, what it means to work this hard. That really resonates to me, you know, when I'm trying to type and work and my 10-year-old comes in and he's like, you know, "What are you doing?" It's not like as opaque as, you know, building something or whatever, like serving tables or something. And it's all very mystical. But at the same time, it's just, and it has that duality too, right? Where she has to do this while also washing clothes and also going out and helping in the fields.
I think that speaks a lot to just women's role women's roles as mother and as artist or breadwinner or whatever, you know, it's expanded much more now, right? No matter how much you might achieve, no matter how good you might be at something, of course your children are going to primarily see you as mother, right? But also just society at large women are still, I think, we're battling with this mothers are still battling with this dual identity, right? This sort of split identity where you have to be everything to your children and your family, and still have to nurture this professional side of yourself or this artistic side of yourself kind of on the side, even though that might be the identity that you really want to embrace. And another thing that I think resonates today.
Yeah, definitely. I think the pandemic really was horrible on women and working mothers who had to all of a sudden be the school teachers too, and had to do all that and still being expected to do all for the family and, you know, their careers. So it's definitely stuff that is still relevant. And it was really, I love the 17 syllables and what you talked about there, because she's writes about so many themes that reoccur, like the isolation and inadequacy. And she kind of stereotypes, but doesn't use stereotypes, because they're really about the complexity of being human and the, you know, the requirements of, you know, family, your culture and everything else into what drives people. And I found her story is really compelling in that way. It's just the humanness that she was able to tap into.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, I feel like there's so much, my initial read of a lot of her work was about women who have been constrained and confined and ultimately in a lot of ways defeated and, by these, you know, by men who don't want them to be fully human. But then sort of on a second, third read, I realized the men also are defeated, right? They too are trapped by their circumstances and just aren't equipped emotionally, you know, financially to embrace anything other than just sort of what they're stuck with.
Very true.
What I really appreciate about another thing that I really appreciate about her as a writer is that I think that, like all good writers, she doesn't fall into just simple good or bad, that even the characters who are the most flawed, you know, in particular, these fathers and husbands who are frequently abusive and who really destroy their wives' careers, you can see through and you can hear through those silences, even through the young protagonists' perspectives, how the men are being hurt by racism and you know, the against Japanese Americans and other Asian Americans, and you know, and also class prejudices stemming back from Japan. So really how they too are constrained, exactly as you were saying, Misa. So they're not like these just straw men villains.
Yeah, that's a good point. She writes with such empathy that even if, you know, it's kind of an abusive husband, but you can understand what his motivations are. Like, she does such a great job in defining the motivations and making the reader understand where different people are coming from. As in the 17 syllables, you know, the Hispanic family that is working for them, you know, you kind of understand where they're coming from too. And she does a nice job of weaving that kind of romance and coming of age together, highlighting their differences and their similarities and everyone's kind of teenage world. So it's really, it's just, I can't help but say powerful again, just
because. Yeah. And I'm so glad that you picked up on that detail of that passage, which, as you're saying, becomes a full-blown plot point about this budding young relationship. Wait, that is 17 syllables, right? Is it Rosie and Jesus? It's like they start to meld a bit. But yeah, that he, you know, and that I think is so important about the way that she humanizes all these characters, even like literally and figuratively marginal characters, like this Mexican American family, you know, who are doing the work. They're part of the material labor that makes possible the Japanese American family's comfort and even the mother's writing. And so, you know, Yamamoto really acknowledges the labor, both the gendered labor, but also the racial labor that goes into making art possible, and humanizes all of the working, the laboring people.
Mm-hmm. Definitely humanizes. Yeah. So, you know, we touched on a little bit, Misa, with the Me Too movement. How do you think Yamamoto would be engaged with our current world, including the Me Too, but beyond that, and other justice issues?
Oh yeah, I feel like she would be fully engaged. She would be writing. She would be protesting. You know, like her biography is there's quite a lot of activism, right, on behalf of the Black community in Los Angeles. But she joined
the LA Tribune, she wrote for, yeah,
which was a Black run newspaper, and she, like, most notably, I remember just from reading her biography, knowing about her biography a little bit, was she actually did organize picketing protest of a local swimming pool that was not allowing Black community members to swim there. And I think she wrote quite a lot about race relations, and very openly and very directly, I think, for, you know, I feel like it was such a big, brave thing for a woman, especially to do, a woman of color.
Cheryl, what do you think?
Yeah, to build on Misa's points, I think another way in which Yamamoto is so important and relevant to us today is really in confronting anti-Black racism in mm-hmm. particular. And how brave it was for her as a woman, and specifically as a Japanese American woman at that time, because there was and is so much racism, and especially anti-Black racism, in Asian American communities and families. And it's really important and heartening to see that change. I think there's, you know, I mean, because of individuals and also movements, I mean, obviously the civil rights movement, Black Power, and now all of the anti-policing, police brutality movements, Black Lives Matter, have had such a huge impact on all Americans and people throughout the world. So, you know, you have Asians for Black Lives, you have Asian Americans who are now really taking an active stance in yoking movements for justice for all Asian Americans, and yoking that with movements for all people, including African Americans. And he said, and that's another reason that reading Yamamoto's work, including Fire and Fontana, is really useful for coming to grips with the struggling against anti-Black racism, but also how difficult that is, and how hard of a process it is, and how many mistakes we can make, but how necessary it is to do that.
I'm glad you mentioned the Fire in Fontana, because that, you know, was short story based on her actual interaction as a journalist for the LA Tribune, where the Short family was, you know, being bullied and harassed in the community, and eventually
they were killed.
Then their house was burned down. The investigation ruled it arson, but everyone knew it was otherwise. And I think the part of that, and Yamamoto reporting on that, and the constraints she felt, I think, of journalism, kind of put fuel more into her short story writing and into that. You know, I have to be objective as a journalist, but as a short story writer, I can editorialize and tell you exactly what is right and wrong mm-hmm. in these situations. And I think, you know, her work as a journalist, it was some amazing stuff she was doing with the LA Tribune, how they were really trying to early on in the late 40s there, make an interracial paper, you know, trying to, as we pointed out early on, Misa, when the internments happened and Japanese Americans were forced to give up their businesses, their property, a lot of their belongings, and then others moved into those neighborhoods while they were interred for those 3 years or so, then they came back and wanted to go back to their old communities. And now it was like, well, we have to meld these together. And I think she was kind of an early proponent of, well, yeah, this can work. You know, we were interned and, you know, abused as a society for 3 years, but the African Americans had suffered much, much longer, is a paraphrase of a quote that Yamamoto had said. But I think her exposure there really helped shape her short story writing in a different way.
And I think it's worth noting that the paper, was it LA Tribune, was the only Los Angeles paper that spoke out against the internment, against the sort of mistreatment of Japanese Americans during World War II, which I think is, you know, just says so much about Black activism and what Asian Americans, what everybody owes the leaders of the Black leaders of the civil rights movement.
Yeah, justice should be not only, you know, blind, but colorblind too. The justice statue with the blindfold, it's should be that way for everyone. Justice should be fair and equal. And it's, you know, Yamamoto, I believe you're right, should be out there in the front saying it's not equal right now. It's not fair, you know? So I'm also curious, if do you think Yamamoto's writing has impacted your life and your work in ways you might not have thought of before we started to talk about these things today, or before you were thinking of doing this recording?
I again came across her work in a time when there was very, very little work that was well known by Asian American authors. Amy Tan's The Joy Luck Club had just come out like the year previous, and I just drank that book right up. And then when I, the following year, read Yamamoto, it was the same experience that I had with The Joy Luck Club, which was, I didn't know that you could write about the Asian American experience. You know, I didn't realize that our lives and our history were worthy of being in a book that a lot of people would read and care about. And then again, rereading it now, there's so much, because because of segregation, and because her stories are set in the camps often, or, you know, on the farms with other, you know, in Japanese American communities, all the characters, so many of the characters are Japanese American, have Japanese names. And it was such a joy to me then, and still now, to read those names, and they're just part of the story. You know, they're not the Japanese character, you know, the doctor or the exchange student. It's a full world of Asian Americans, and, you know, and it's complex and it's flawed, and there are all kinds of problems going on, but they're real stories that center Asian Americans. And that struck me then, and that's has stuck with me throughout my adult life.
Nice. Cheryl, how about you?
Yeah. You know, being able to read her Yamamoto's stories, especially the stories about internment, like the legend of Miss Sasagawara in particular, but also the full range of her stories about dealing with racism, with growing up as a, you know, as a Nisei second generation. They were such a revelation to me, both because of, especially, you know, in the 80s and 90s, the radio silence in the mainstream media on Japanese American and Asian American representation, again, as Misa was saying, but also because of my own parents and family silence around their own experiences in the camp. So my mother was interned in the Poston camp, like Hisai Yamamoto. And it's just so amazing to me to think that they would have overlapped. And my mom would have been exactly 10 years younger than Yamamoto. And I wish that I had known about Hisai Yamamoto much earlier. So I could have, I mean, I don't know if they could have ever crossed paths, or my mom would have, you know, remembered her, but I would have loved to have asked my mom if she had any recollection somehow. And my father was at the Manzanar camp in California. And, you know, they didn't want to talk a lot about those experiences, or when they would share kind of funny anecdotes, which was great to hear, but they didn't, and also they were so young at the time. So, and the same with my uncles and aunts, although as they grew older, they were more willing to share a bit more. My neighbors, I grew up in a Japanese American community in Monterey Park and near East LA. And, you know, there just wasn't a lot of time. So being able to read about this, you know, history, you know, the way that literature can get at historical and social truths in some ways that objective journalism as well as history can't, right? It was so gratifying and nourishing to have, especially from a female feminist perspective. So that was really important to me, because that was the way that I got my history through these short stories. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, more books have, and histories have, and literature have come out, you know, since then. And Yamamoto was a real groundbreaker in that respect, in opening up that silence. But another really important difference that she's made to me is that she's part of what the Asian American scholar Diane Fujino calls a Nisei radical, who breaks the stereotype of the Japanese American and Asian American model minority. And Misa, I know that your work importantly does that as well. And, you know, there's that idea from these articles that were coming out in the New York Times and US News and World Report, right? Positioning Chinese and Japanese Americans in particular as the good, obedient citizens, as opposed to these violent and savage African Americans, right? And then there was also the way in which Japanese Americans felt that they had to prove their patriotism in order to overcome that stigma of being interned and seen as enemy aliens and perpetual foreigners. And, you know, while that's a really understandable reaction to state violence and incarceration, which is what internment was, you know, it's also very harmful to ourselves and to the struggle for racial justice. And so the fact that you had so many brave writers and activists like Hisai Yamamoto, or, you know, her friend Wakako Yamauchi and Mitsuyi Yamada, and all the figures that Diane and others study is so important as a kind of role model for other ways that we as Japanese Americans and Asian Americans can be in the world, that we don't have to conform and reproduce these stereotypes, and that we can really struggle for racial justice and social justice in these really radical ways.
I think you kind of raised a good point. I want to make sure our listeners really understand that wanting to kind of prove themselves to be American or to be patriotic, how during the internment of her family, I see Hasei's younger brother went and fought in World War II and was killed in action, you know, as his family is locked up, the other Americans in his family are interred, you know. So I really want our listeners to explore Yamamoto's work, you know, check out our exhibits to get a little taste of it, but really read her stuff and learn about her history, because it's our history. It's our shared history. It's our American history. And she does such a good job in writing about it from her point of view. But I think everyone should know more about the history of it, because as we talked a little bit before we started recording, Misa, and you pointed out that your local library doesn't carry this book, 17 Syllables, The Collected Short Stories. That is, it's unfathomable to me that in the Bay Area they don't carry her work. That's sad.
Yeah. The crime. and it's just, it's so many wonderful things, right? I mean, apart from the way it's so grounded in the history of Japanese Americans, in American history, really, in California history, it is, I mean, just on its own, just amazing writing, the prose, the sort of the denseness of her stories is.
There's a subtlety to her stories, and this, she satirizes all cultures kind of in a subtle way in some of her stories. So that kind of, I think you, Cheryl, you had mentioned maybe she was kind of subversive in a way. And I think a bit through her fiction, she achieves that in the themes she addresses and the beauty of her language and how she does it. So I really appreciate you both talking with the American Writers Museum and us today about Hasei Yamamoto, and we really want to encourage people to read her. Get out there and read her, because she was published in, was it 1948, and the Partisan Review, along with Camus and Saul Bellow. I mean, she deserves to be up in the names that people talk about when they talk about short stories.
Yeah, so. For sure. I mean, really one of the great American writers, absolutely for sure.
Definitely. And I don't know, we're getting close on our time here, so I don't know if you guys have anything you want to say in conclusion or to wrap up or to even promote your upcoming projects or things. That's fine. Cheryl, do you want to start with that?
Well, actually, there's one last thing that I want to say. There was one question that we tangentially touch on, but it was about... with the understanding that quote unquote American, since you couldn't see my fingers, scare quotes, with the understanding that quote unquote American and who gets to claim that is complicated and problematic, what about Yamamoto's writing makes it uniquely American? And I had wanted to touch on that really quickly, because for me, what makes Yamamoto's writing uniquely American is how she deals with race and racism as a fundamentally American history that is still with us, as we've been talking about, and that continues to be very, very timely. And so, you know, I think it's important for people who read her to really appreciate how her multiculturalism and her expansive explorations of interracial relationships of Japanese Americans with Mexican Americans, with African Americans, with other ethnic Asian Americans like Filipino Americans is so timely in the ways that we've been discussing. But I would say that it's not about trying to achieve a kind of colorblind justice, because in my reading, she recognizes that because of America's history rooted in slavery, in genocide, in the appropriation, the continued appropriation of indigenous lands, and the expansion into and occupation of Mexico, it's really not possible to overcome race, and that colorblindness, in fact, can lead us to ignore the way that race continues to operate on so many pernicious levels. And, you know, she was always so brave, I think, in continuing to explore that reality of how race continues to shape us. And that is what I think is one of her important legacies, that she's really asking us to have that courage to acknowledge that race and racism are so very much a part of who we are and what we need to continue to work through, regardless of whether we're Asian or white or Black or Indigenous or Chicano or Latinx.
Yeah, I think she was so far. I just want to, yeah, just jump on that a little bit, is that she was so far ahead of her time, I think, in the way that she addressed race. Just in particular, this one story, the Brown House, where Mrs. the Hattori family, Mr. Hattori is going to this like sort of gambling den, a multiracial gambling den, because everybody loves to gamble, I guess. And the Hattori family, the mother, Mrs. Hattori, and her four children or her children are waiting outside for Mr. Hattori to come out. And then there's a police raid and everyone runs away from the house. And a Black man jumps into their car and says, please just hide me. And then it's fine for a little while. And then Mr. Hattori comes out, they drive away, and the man in the back, the Black man, says, thanks. Let me out here, please. Thank you so much. And says the thing of like, I've always been a big like fan of your people. You're so clean. You're so disciplined. And says the model minority spiel. I'll never forget this. I owe you. And he runs away. And I don't know if white readers back then would have picked up on that or not, if anyone, but maybe even Asian readers might not have picked up on that, the racism behind that comment. But then of course it turns right around and we see just how racist Mr. Hattori is, because he uses a Japanese derogatory word for Black people. And so, you know, why would you let him into the car? And his wife responds, well, that, you know, it wasn't a problem to be with him in the gambling house, you know, what's changed? And she just sort of leaves that there for us to digest. That's such a sort of, yeah, to me, that sort of encapsulates what she was trying to say in so many of her pieces. And it's just one detail, one small detail of a larger story, which is, you know, another thing I love about her work. She'll just drop something small in there, just a little gem, and it fits in the story, but it's also something you can take out and really examine closely.
That's great. Thank you for bringing those idea of the quote unquote American back around, because that is a big part of what she's writing about. Like you said, she's just showing you and not saying things, and just in such a strong way. That was a great example. Thank you so much. Cheryl and Misa, thank you both for doing this today and for speaking with me. And
yeah. Thanks so much. It was really fun. And Cheryl, it was great to meet you. Well, I guess all of you, great to meet you and talk to you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Nation of Writers podcast, part of the American Writers Museum podcast network. The series continues next month with a new episode airing June 30th. We want to remind you that Misa's new book also comes out next month. Love and Other Natural Disasters will be released on June 8th and has been praised by the American Library Association as hilariously awkward and honestly poignant. We certainly can't wait to read it. If you'd like to learn more about American writers and their impact on our history, our culture, and our daily lives, explore our virtual exhibit, American Voices, now available at nationofwriters.org. Again, that's nationofwriters.org. Once again, thank you for listening. And for all you writers out there, thank you for writing.